KEXP thanks contributing donors and the Real Networks Foundation for supporting Mind Over Matters.
This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. My guest this morning is David Wilma, author, writer, and former deputy director and staff historian of HistoryLink.org, an evolving online encyclopedia of Washington state and local history. David Wilma is here today to tell us about his book, Power for the People, A History of Seattle City Light, co-authored with Walt Crowley and the History Link staff, and published in 2010 by the University of Washington Press. Welcome, David.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
What led you to write Power for the People? How did the book come about?
The book came about from the mind of Walt Crowley. We lost Walt about 3 years ago. Walt was the founder of HistoryLink.org, the free online encyclopedia of Washington state history. And an early supporter of HistoryLink was Seattle City Light, among other agencies and institutions. And we started documenting the history of the utility on the encyclopedia through a series of relatively short essays. But from that grew the idea of actually doing a full-length book on the history of the utility because it was such a compelling story.
What was it like in Seattle before electricity was available?
Before electricity, Seattle stumbled through the dark and the rain. If they had light, it was by kerosene lamps or whale oil or even oil pressed from fish, so it was pretty stinky. The idea of using gas for lighting came in the 1870s. Now, this was not natural gas like we are used to seeing, but it was gas distilled from coal. Back in the 19th century and the early part of the 20th century, there was a lot of coal mined here in the Puget Sound region. So there was a lot of coal, and it was placed into retorts and cooked down and made into gas, which was piped through the streets in wooden pipes, basically logs that were hollowed out and then reattached. Then in 1879, Thomas Edison invented the incandescent light. There were other light sources with electricity, but the incandescent light was the first that was actually commercially viable. And that light first came to Seattle in 1886. So electricity then grew to the turn of the century as, first of all, a convenience and then as a necessary utility.
As you speak about in your book, when Seattle was first provided with electricity, the companies were private rather than public. How effective were the private companies and what were some of the drawbacks?
In those days, over 100 years ago, private companies handled all public utilities, garbage, water, in this case, light, gas, transportation. But the problem was is that these companies had franchises from the city council, but there wasn't much in the way of enforcement of the conditions of the franchises, and there was no limits on the cost that could be imposed by these companies on the consumers. So if a company had a franchise to run a streetcar line and the streetcar line was supposed to have paving around the tracks, there was nobody to watch the company and make sure that the tracks weren't all exposed and people would trip on the tracks. It's the same thing with electricity. There was no way to govern how the electricity was to be distributed. In other words, who would get service? We have service in all neighborhoods now, but that was not always the case. So the companies basically determined it, and they would charge what the market would bear. So the service was uneven, and it was expensive.
How did Seattle first come to have a public electric utility? Why was municipal ownership proposed?
The story actually starts with the Great Fire, June 6, 1889. A glue pot boiled over on First Avenue and set some sawdust on fire, and most of downtown was incinerated by nightfall. When the firemen went to the fire hydrants to get water, there was no water because the privately owned utility that provided water hadn't done their job. So the city council immediately put a matter on the ballot, and the residents voted to have the water utility purchased by the city and run by the city. At that time, the water was piped from Lake Washington. Part of the long-range plan was not just to provide for water, but for street lighting as well. And in 1902, the voters passed a bond issue to build a lighting plant on the Cedar River near North Bend. The lighting plant would provide for street lighting for the city. Any extra light would then be sold to the residents.
Would you speak about the nature of the competition that took place between the private companies and Seattle's municipally owned utility?
The competition was, to call it fierce, is probably an understatement. The whole battle is the only thing that you can call it between the principal utility in Seattle after 1911, which was Puget Sound Traction Light and Power, later Puget Sound Power and Light, and Seattle City Light, was nasty. First of all, there were two electrical utilities providing power to Seattle. So as a consequence, there were often two sets of wires running down streets, with the Seattle City Light having the wires at the highest location and Puget Sound or the company at the lowest location. So there was a fierce competition for customers. For example, the salesman, the light salesman, would follow moving vans to find out where the people were moving in. And sometimes even two salesmen would show up on someone's front porch offering them electrical service, quite like somebody offering you cell phone service or telephone service or cable television service, only it was very, very competitive. Lots and lots of stories in the book about how the competition went. But it got political as well, because the private power interests managed to get through the state legislature certain legislation that severely limited the ability of City Light to do its business. For example, the state legislature passed a law in, I think, 1915 that prohibited any municipal-owned utility from selling their power outside the city. The city limits of Seattle were much smaller in those days, and if you lived across the street from the city limits, you couldn't get your power from City Light, even though you're just a few feet away. Or if you lived along the power line that ran from Cedar Falls to Seattle, you couldn't get a power line, what they call a drop. You had to buy the power from a private power company, which may or may not have wires to that particular neighborhood. So that was one thing that was done. City Light figured out a way around it. The father of City Light, he didn't really found it, but the head of City Light for more than 30 years, J.D. Ross, became the target, the personal target of the private power interests. At one point, he found an eavesdropping device in the chimney of his home because they thought he was having business meetings in his home and they wanted to try and record it. So that sort of thing went on. Full-page ads in the newspapers, one saying how great City Light was, the other saying how bad City Light was, depending on who bought the ads. So it was very, very competitive.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is David Wilmo, co-author of the book Power for the People, A History of Seattle City Light. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. How did City Light go about getting sources of power when it was first formed?
City Light's first source of power was hydroelectricity, the power from water falling. And in this case, it was water from the Cedar River, which was already providing drinking water to Seattle. So the idea was to build what's called a penstock, which is the pipe that carries the water from the river, and run it through a couple of, in this case, water wheels, if you can imagine, buckets on a wheel, so that they would spin generators, which would generate the power. And the preference for City Light was always to use hydroelectric power. J.D. Ross wanted, his mantra, he didn't use that term, but his mission was to provide as much electricity as cheaply as possible to the citizens of Seattle for two reasons. First of all, he saw electricity as the wonder product of the age, something that brought light and power and saved energy and energy-saving devices at home. And also, electricity was going to be the basis for economic development. If he could provide cheap electricity, companies would move to Seattle and build their factories, much as they did in the Niagara Falls region. So cheap electricity was going to be the key for economic growth. So hydroelectricity was always the goal. So they exploited the Cedar River as far as they could, but at one point it produced as many kilowatts as they could. And as they started to run out of power is when Ross began to build other plants. He figured out a way to build a little tiny generating station that used the water from the Volunteer Park Reservoir, the drinking water reservoir up on top of the Capitol Hill, and he ran the pipe down to Lake Union and ran it through a little turbine as kind of an auxiliary unit. The building is still there. And it's right next to the Zymogenetics plant, which is the old City Light power plant. Then he started building what we call the City Light power plant in stages, and that used fuel oil from petroleum to fire a boiler. The boiler would make steam. The steam would then turn the turbines, which turned the generators. Ross never liked this because it cost money. He wanted to use free water. So that put him on the course to find more hydroelectric sources in the 1910s. And he ended up being able to stake a claim on the Skagit River, which is where Seattle gets probably a quarter of its power today.
What were some of the challenges in the early days in delivering reliable power to customers?
The first challenge for reliable power was just plain technology, finding the right wires and machines that you could use that would transmit the power from the power station to the city. And the simplest thing was, well, just to run some copper wire. Well, it got more complicated than that. And there was very much decades of experimentation and not particularly good reliability as electrical engineers found the best ways to provide consistent power.
What led to Seattle City Light, the municipally owned utility, prevailing in the competition with the private sector?
City Light prevailed in the public power battles because it ended up becoming more of a national political issue from just a local one. And this started in the 1920s in the area of progressive politics. Movements like the Grange, which represented farmers, particularly in very rural and unserved areas, wanted to get electricity. But it was, quite frankly, very uneconomical for the power companies to run wires miles and miles and miles out to some farm that might buy a dollar and a half worth of electricity a month. So there really was little incentive for the power companies to spend a lot of money quickly to do that. So the answer was public utilities districts. And the public utilities districts came into being in the 1930s, along with Democratic political leaders like Franklin Roosevelt and Homer Bone, who sponsored and promoted the idea of publicly owned utilities. So that by World War II, the city of Seattle was beginning to reconsider whether or not they wanted to renew the franchise for Puget Power, and determined that when the time came, they would buy Puget Power's properties, the wires, the transformers, and one power station, the light plant down by Boeing Field. And that took place in the early 1950s.
In Power for the People, you speak about how City Light encouraged increased use or consumption of electricity in the early days. How did they go about encouraging increased use of electricity? What were some of their methods?
J.D. Ross was very much in favor of using electricity for anything he could think of. So one of the key ways that City Light did that is they sold appliances to customers, to the residents. And there were City Light stores throughout Seattle, and the City Light headquarters in downtown Seattle on 3rd and Madison actually had a showroom on its ground floor where you could go in and buy a washing machine or a range or a hot water heater, and they would actually sell it to residents on time. They had salespeople who were commissions only, so they only made money if they sold something. So the idea was to put these appliances in people's homes to get them to use the electricity. And there's a certain economy of scale. When you build a power plant, you want to sell as much electricity immediately as you can in order to pay back the capital costs of constructing the power plant. So by 1930, Seattle was using more electricity per resident than anyone else in the nation.
What prompted City Light to go from promoting consumption to promoting conservation beginning in the 1970s?
In 1970, Seattle City Light had to go to the city council and ask for the first rate increase in 50 years. They've been able to reduce the rates of electricity consistently from 1920 until it got to be almost a penny a kilowatt hour. But in 1970, more people had moved to the region. The Seattle World's Fair of 1962 had spotlighted the city. The Boeing Company had been growing, although in 1970 it was going to go through a contraction. But they needed more money to pay for power, and they had to begin to charge more. And then the energy crisis of the early 1970s compelled the city to go from promoting energy use to promoting conservation. They had a program called Kilowatt.
How was conservation encouraged? Would you elaborate?
Conservation was encouraged by just not wasting electricity. And one of the first things that people were asked to do was to insulate homes, buildings, and windows. In downtown Seattle, where some buildings were built without light switches because electricity was so cheap, it was just cheaper to leave the lights on, they had to retrofit the buildings with light switches. So the Seattle skyline darkened for a couple of years as they curtailed use to try and conserve electricity.
Would you say more about what led to concerns about the environment becoming part of Seattle City Light's mission?
Concerns from the environment because of City Light operations actually go back to the 1910s, when Seattle first built a dam on the Skagit River. It was going to interfere with the salmon runs. And there was a proposal at the time to compensate the state fish and game for the loss of the salmon run, but they didn't have the money. So it didn't really come up again until the 1970s when the proposal to raise Ross Dam came up. Ross Dam is the third of the dams built on the Skagit River by Seattle City Light, and it was built at Ruby Creek. And it was actually planned to be built in three stages. And when the third stage was going to come in, another 125 feet, this is about in the late 60s, 1970s, when the environmental movement began to surface. People began to say, wait a minute, why do we need to do this? It's going to flood more property, and maybe we just don't need all this electricity. So it actually started with the Ross Dam project. Earlier, there was an issue. It wasn't so much environmental as we think about environmental, but there were objections to all of the wires that people saw on the city streets because the wires were on power poles. And that was a good way to transmit electricity because if there was a problem, you could see the wires and it was cheap. But when the World's Fair came along, some of the leaders said, wait a minute, we don't want our visitors to Seattle to look at all of these ugly wires. And of course, the people at City Light were aghast because, wait a minute, we're not going to spend ratepayers' money just to be pretty. But the city council prevailed, and there was actually a whole series of projects to underground wires in neighborhoods. They have to put the wires underground in downtown just because of the weight of the wires. You can't put them on power poles, so they have to go underground. But out in neighborhoods, some of the neighborhoods actually had their wires put underground, which eliminated the power poles, but the residents had to pay part of the cost. So as a consequence, only the wealthier neighborhoods had their lines undergrounded. So things came together in the early 1970s where environmental concerns started to be considered as part of energy policy.
You are listening to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is David Wilma. Our topic is his book, Power for the People, A History of Seattle City Light, co-authored with Walt Crowley and the History Link staff. How did citizen involvement in City Light change over time?
In the beginning, Seattle City Light was a city department. The superintendent of lighting, it was actually technically called the Department of Lighting, was appointed by the mayor, and his term was renewed periodically by the city council. So the citizen involvement in the early years came as a result of natural political influence of the city council over budgets and policy. The thing about City Light is they did not spend tax money. They made their own money, so they could run it like a business. So if they needed to buy something, they just put it in the budget, and they bought it and then told the city council about it. There were members of the city council who were very friendly. This is in about 1930. Members of the city council and the mayor at the time were very friendly to Puget Power, and they had in their hands J.D. Ross's career. And the mayor, one afternoon, shortly before an election, decided he was going to fire Ross, and he did, claiming that he was going to get rid of communists in the Department of Lighting. It was in a long afternoon lunch, so alcohol may have played a factor in his decision. As a consequence, the progressive politicians in the city filed a recall campaign against Mayor Edwards. Ross had spent many years cultivating a very high profile among Seattle residents, and he would be out every night visiting community clubs and community groups, talking about City Light, talking about the hydro project on the Skagit River. And so he was a very, very popular individual. And as a consequence of being fired by Mayor Edwards was recalled. He was turned out of office. And Ross came back to City Light to continue service. But because of that action, City Light enjoyed about 30 years of hands-off by the elected politicians, until the late 1960s, when a new group of progressive politicians came into office through a program called Choose an Effective City Council. And some of those city council members began to read the City Light annual reports and start to ask questions. Well, tell us about the money. And they discovered a number of things that City Light was kind of doing its own thing without involving the elected officials or the community. Like at one point, they bought an island to build a nuclear reactor, and they took money that was supposed to use to underground the wires to build another dam up in northeastern Washington. So when Mayor Wes Ullman took office in 1969, he embarked on a whole program of increasing citizen involvement and impaneling a whole variety of citizen advisory groups, including some directed at City Light. So City Light then had to pay more attention to the concerns of residents and groups within the city rather than just making their own decisions based upon their sense of what was best for the city.
You alluded to buying land for a nuclear power plant. Would you like to speak about Seattle City Light's use of nuclear power?
In the 1950s and 60s, nuclear power was seen as the answer to all of the electrical needs. And in the construction of hydroelectric plants, all of the available sources had been taken up. And in fact, in the 50s and 60s, those last hydro projects encountered a lot of opposition, particularly from fishermen and other groups, other environmental groups. So there weren't really any more places that you could build the big hydro projects like we see on the Columbia and the Skagit. So nuclear was seen as the way to go. And City Light got together with the Snohomish County Public Utilities District and said, well, let's build a nuclear power plant. And they found an island near Anacortes. It's called Kicket Island. And they bought the island with the view toward building the nuclear power plant. And then at that time, the superintendent then advised the city council. The city council went, what? You what? And then people started asking questions about, well, if nuclear power is so safe, why don't you put it on Harbor Island instead of Kicket Island? So the whole nuclear power program, at least for City Light, got shoved aside. Then the Washington Public Power Supply System, which was a consortium of public utilities districts and Seattle City Light and Tacoma City Light, made plans to build a series of nuclear power plants in the 1970s. And Seattle signed on to the first couple of plants, but then because of citizen opposition, they did not sign on to a couple of the subsequent plants. And then the WPPS system, they had way over-projected the need for electricity, and the whole construction of these power plants was a major debacle, which earned WPPS the nickname Whoops. And they ended up defaulting on billions of dollars of bonds, but the whole political and environmental movement in Seattle steered City Light away from the idea of nuclear power, and City Light began to adopt the idea of conservation as in meeting load growth. In other words, if you needed another megawatt of electricity, let's cut back on the need for a megawatt of electricity, and it'll be just like building a new power plant. And that's been the City Light policy since the 1970s. They have added power sources and actually backed out of power sources. For example, in 1968, they bought into a state-of-the-art coal-fired power plant in Centralia. City Light owned like 8% of this power plant because there were coal fields nearby and they would just burn the coal and make electricity. But the city and City Light never really liked burning coal for electricity, and they got out of that deal in the early 2000s. So there were other small hydro projects. They'd find small irrigation projects that they could build a little power plant. Then they started buying power off of the open market. They would buy it from other power companies, because by that time the electricity grid had grown so that you could actually buy power from California.
Overall, how has having a publicly owned utility affected the development of the city of Seattle?
The citizen-owned utility in Seattle has made it possible for the city to grow with far, far less money being spent on energy than might have been the case. So the millions and even billions of dollars saved by ratepayers went into other things, whether it was roads or other kinds of economic development. It also made it possible, the whole idea of public power made it possible for the construction of industries like aluminum plants along the Columbia River, where there are really, really big dams. And in the 1990s, it made it possible for the construction of server farms, the computer networks that power the internet, although they consume vast quantities of electricity. And the city actually had to pass a policy that if you were going to build a business or build something that required a whole lot of electricity, you had to bring your own electricity. But overall, for 100 years, the idea of having cheap electricity made it possible for the city to grow and for individual residents to prosper, paying half to a quarter of what they would have for their electrical power.
What do you see as the key challenges for Seattle City Light in the future?
Well, City Light will continue to need to provide electricity at low cost, and the biggest challenge is to do it in an environmentally friendly manner. They are using wind power. It is not as cheap as hydropower, and they are learning how to get more out of the hydropower projects that they have. As they go back in and retrofit these dams, which were built in the 1920s and 30s and even the 1960s, it's possible to take advantage of additional technology and get more power out of the existing machinery.
What do you hope your book will accomplish?
Well, I hope that the readers, either residents of Seattle or anyone interested in the whole idea of public power, will see that it was not easily done. There's a lot of drama to it. There's even melodrama when it comes to some of the conflicts and challenges that took place. But it's a fascinating story and involves very, very interesting people who had a vision of cheap power for Seattle so that Seattle could grow and that the residents could prosper. One of the things that I've noticed is that in discussions of providing a broadband internet service, most of which is done by private companies now on franchises granted by city councils, there is also a discussion of, well, maybe the cities ought to provide that. Now, Tacoma has their own internet system, and I believe the city of Seattle has experimented with some neighborhood internet service. The idea being that, and this comes back from the late 19th century, is that some of these things are natural monopolies. And rather than have two electricity systems or two or three internet systems, if we had just one, and the internet, which was 10 or 15 years ago considered a gee whiz convenience, is now an absolute necessity for the functioning of our economy. So ultimately, it's going to be a political problem. And the question will be, is are the private companies able to provide the service efficiently and at a fair cost? And so conversations that I see about providing internet service are exactly the same discussions that happened 100 years ago.
And what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
That when you turn on the lights, that there's a lot behind it, a lot of people, a lot of good, dedicated people behind it. One of the things that really impressed me about City Light was the dedication that the employees demonstrate in their work. And I think they are truly committed to the idea of providing an essential public service, and they take great pride in that.
Well, thanks so much for being here, David.
Thank you.
You have just been listening to David Wilma speak about his book, Power for the People, A History of Seattle City Light, co-authored with Walt Crowley and the HistoryLink staff, and published in 2010 by the University of Washington Press. For more information, check on the web at www.davidwilma.com. That's DavidWilma.com. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and kexp.org.